Captain Bauer, Reel 6.
You were mentioning earlier on that there was overall a very low level of casualties in the battalion. What sort of effect did it have on the battalion's morale when you did suffer from casualty?
I think it was pretty electric. Because, for obvious reasons, we lived very closely together. There was probably more personal relationship in that situation than they had previously been accustomed to. And there you were, there you were going to be for a certain period of time. And you were fairly close, you lived in very close conditions, and your mates were your mates, and this kind of thing. And I think that it was people were wounded or killed or something, the reverberations were pretty strong. You know, the word got around very quickly, and of course there was news and brought up with the rations and all this kind of thing. And I think that people did mind very much if people were killed or wounded and they wanted to know about it, you know. Because we were all living, all of us in the line, very close to this kind of stuff. But people did mind, and it was important. You know, if your friend had been wounded or killed, very important stuff.
How were casualties handled?
Casualty evacuation was very good. It was the days of the helicopter, which were quite early, like the MASH thing. It was, I think, during the Korean War that the helicopter really first came into its own. We had, as I say, you know, once you were out of the line, you were out of the line. A matter of 200-300 yards made all the difference. And you could get people off the hill very quickly. You had your casualty clearing post, CCP, and usually behind, there was usually a jeep or two per company headquarters, and you could get people out quite quickly. It was obviously the casualties in patrol positions, situations which were very much more difficult. But from actually evacuating someone from a hill position was good, and you could be into hospital in a short space of time, depending on, you know, where you were. But there were jeep ambulances, and then if it was serious, you could be helicoptered out to Seoul, and then you could be whisked across to Hong Kong or wherever, you know. Not Hong Kong. Yes, Hong Kong. I don't mean Hong Kong at all, do I? Where did we go? Japan. But casualty evacuation was very efficient and very quick.
I think you were wounded towards the end of your term and career. How did that happen?
I was extremely fortunate. At that time, I was commanding the medium machine gun platoon, and as I think I've previously explained, the machine gun sections were scattered around, being four, that is, being scattered around the battalion. And this was an afternoon when I'd been visiting the positions, and very near the end of the war, and we were in a position which was shellable as opposed to being mortarable. If one can say that. We were therefore at some distance away from the Chinese, and they were shelling, and a stray shell landed right in front of my jeep. I had I said I would drive it on that particular occasion. My driver was, I think he was called Waits, can't remember, I think it was Waits, and we'd swapped. I was driving, he was sitting by my side, and it was one of those things that had we been a split second later or a split second earlier, we'd have both been killed. And as it happened, the shell landed right in front of the Jeep, and most of the explosion was taken by the engine and the bonnet. It's amazing what it did. I mean, I remember a piece of shrapnel actually grazed the sides of my glasses, and it went through the front struts of the windscreen, because there was no roof to the Jeep at that time. And I mean, unbelievable. And there was this blinding flash and things and smoke, and I saw my Waits fall to one side, and Christ, he's been hit. But in fact, he wasn't at all. And he said, you've been hit, sir. And Geordie said, I saw you've been hit. And there was a lot of blood, but it was really nothing. It was only a scratch. And I was very, very lucky. That's what it was. It was a shell. But it could have been. Could have been much worse. But I actually spent 10 days in hospital, which was most enjoyable. First time I'd slept between sheets for a year, and then we went back to the line, and then very soon after that the war was over. But it was an experience.
How were you removed to the hospital? Can you remember what happened to you?
Very distinctly, because it took a long time, and because I wasn't seriously wounded. We waited for an ambulance to take me out, and we went back to, I think it was an American or Canadian field ambulance. It took quite a long time, but one was in such a state of relaxation, actually. It was a funny sort of, I don't think I'd had any medication or anything like that, but I'd had this lump up here. It was either here or there.
On your brow?
Yeah. And I remember the commanding officer later, he said that Bauer had been hit, and he said, where's he been hit? And he said, hit in the head. And he said, oh, that'll be all right. That won't matter very much. And I think it was evening. I think we were hit about tea time, and it was evening before I went into the operating theatre. It was the American doctors, and it was a very local operation. And they put me to bed, and I had a very comfortable time for 10 days. But it was. I was very lucky.
What was your logistic arrangement like when you were in the line? Did it work effectively for food, ammunition,
yes,
water, and so on?
Yes, we were. Generally speaking, the lines of communication were very good. I suppose probably were a classic example of a static situation when the lines of communication were well established. Battalion headquarters and I forgot what the name of the other headquarters was called now, but where the colour sergeants were and where the mail came to, rations, latrine powder, mail, everything used to come up with very regular. We were extremely well serviced because it was comparatively easy. The boys at the back were under no duress at all, really. Our rations came up regularly. We had American rations, generally speaking, so that you had your individual rations, which you prepared yourself. It was all very good. Had your own loo paper and your sweet tablets and your stuff, it was all in a pack every day. It was marvellous. And it was pretty good, really. Very seldom, if it had been pissing with rain or there had been some unexpected barrage or something, things were late. But generally speaking, we were extremely well looked after.
Did you do your own cooking, or did you have a batman to cook for you when you were in the line?
Well, we had our batman servants, batman, in the line with us, but they were very much more a member of the platoon. They lived, one had one's platoon headquarters, Hutchie, And there you had a wireless operator, your batman, and yourself, could be your platoon sergeant. He may have had a hoochie next door or something like that. It depended very much on the geography, circumstances of the position that you went into. But generally speaking, your batman might have notched something up for you, or you did it yourself, you know. It was all terribly simple. Every ration pack had its own cooker stand and pellet for burning. You know, you put a match to it and it cooked for a certain amount. You had beans and stew and beans and stuff. And the ration, they seemed to be work, because no one went down with anything. You know, everyone seemed to have enough to eat. And it was pretty good, really. But generally one, I think, from what I remember, I looked after myself, I think.
What was your relationship with your company commander? Did you see him frequently, or...?
Yes, they kept in pretty close touch. My company commander, being in support company, lived at battalion quarters, and so I... Or further, I mean, depending on what he was doing, they couldn't have had a great deal to do, really. And so he wasn't actually living on site. And he used to come up with rations from time to time, have a chat, that sort of thing. But otherwise, the rifle companies had the, of course, the company commander living on the spot. But as I was looking after either Brownings or machine, right, the company commander lived either at battalion quarters or and doing something like that, and so he would come up and visit from time to time and visit the various positions. So, and relationships, of course, were very good. But they didn't, my company commander didn't actually play an enormous part in... You were very much more answerable to the company commander in whose position you were. And, you know, that sort of thing. So you talked to the company commander of the rifle platoon, and you were sitting in his territory, and so he was your immediate boss, as it were.
So you were dealing with four company commanders then, essentially.
Yes, A, B, C, and D company.
How did you get on with them? Did you find that they differed at all in their outcome?
Oh yes, oh very much.
Really?
Oh Lord, yes. Different, like anywhere else, different style of management, different style of chap. Absolutely, and you know they ran their ship according to their own style, and they were all different. It's very interesting, really, because you could, provided you know, obviously you had to conform to a certain extent. But generally speaking, they were all different, ran a different kind of show.
How did they differ? Could you enlarge on that a little?
Yes, I think that. Two examples I can think of. John Tresorna, who was killed, was a great cricketer, and he was a fanatic about keeping the area clean, especially when you went into reserve. He'd have signs about, you know, no smoking and keep your hoochie tidy and all this kind of stuff. And he was a great ball game player, you know. And he was a terrific character. And there was another chap called Reggie Atkinson, who commanded, I think, C Company at the time, and he'd been quite a hero during the Second World War, and it didn't seem to matter to him whether it was day or night, and he would be up all night and all day and telling people what to do, you know. It was like that. It was like that. Of course they all conformed, but they ran their private thing very much their own way.
What about the third company commander?
Well, there were...
You mentioned two so far.
Four, well, let me see, I can't remember. There were just two characters, as it were, who... my company commander, he was a funny chap anyway, but he didn't... He didn't impress me very much. He's a rather boring man. You see, there was another one who was wounded, very badly wounded, called, what's his Christian name? I can't remember his Christian name. But he was a Scot, and he got badly wounded and died later, but much later. But he ran his, you know, John Kelly, he was a Scot, and he ran his, he was a very meticulous Scot, and he ran his thing in his own way. The second in command, who was, I think, also doing some of this recording, I mean, he was that sort of funny position of being next in line, waiting for the commanding officer to, you know, if he was to be wounded or killed, he would take over. And so he was in the shadows most of the time, but he was a great character too. Very nice man, but great character.
Were you aware then of any sort of sense of ambition amongst more senior officers?
No, I can't say that ever came my way. It could be that being a very young, fairly naive officer at the time, the thought of, you know, people being ambitious hadn't yet crossed my path. They were all, you know, one... It was rather like being at school, in that your housemaster was always very much older than you were, which he wasn't, really. Or your house prefects, you know. And I think when I was in the army, where was I then? I was 20, 22. And your company commander was probably 32, I suppose. Probably been in the war. All very sensitive, keen people, really. You didn't think of ambition. You know, it was too early. Probably one should have done, you know, but I think that that didn't really play its part. They were all sort of getting the battalion through Korea and doing the best they could, making sure that you had a good company. And I think that was just about it, really.
You mentioned sleep. Were you able to sleep when you were in the line?
Oh, yes. Yes, you had to get your sleep. It was very important to see that everybody else got their sleep. And in the normal course of events, you would sleep during the day, as I think I've previously said. That was, or at some stage during the day, you'd probably find that you might be up most of the day and you could sleep in the afternoon, or between 4 o'clock and wake up at six when you felt simply dreadful. But, you know, you got into a way of life, into a way that, from the men's point of view, if they weren't digging during the day, and they, or whatever, because the majority of life went on during night time, there was stood to or something, you found that you could work it somehow, you know, but you had to sleep.
But you were probably in a worse position than other platoon commanders, because your platoon was spread out amongst the companies, wasn't it?
Well, it was when I was leading machine gun platoon, then I lived in battalion quarters. But during the time I was running a Browning platoon, it was very much as history would relate on the reels. I was like a rifle platoon commander, and I had my hutchie, I had my bed in it, and I took my sleep when I felt that I could take it. You know, and you got into the way of being, and I think you'll find with a lot of regular soldiers they can usually sleep standing up somewhere. Very difficult times we had in Germany, you know, and exercises which went on for 10 days and this kind of thing, and you had to take your sleep whenever you could, and so you really got very used to that kind of thing. And you could be sleeping at your, you know, one had a desk near your radio, you could put your head down and sleep then, you know. But generally speaking, if your platoon sergeant, you switched things around with him, say, okay, I'm going to have a bit of kip now, and call me if you want me. And exactly the same reverse in roles, you know, sleep, and if there's nothing, I won't wake you up until the morning or something, or stand to. We always had a stand to anyway, willy-nilly, you see. It was always a battalion thing, when it was regulated your day. So stand to was so 08, 07:30 or 08:30, that kind of thing, before or after breakfast or something, you know, so that you had a sort of marker. And after that, you probably went and inspected your hutches and your men, and or you had a dawn patrol around your minefields and things. You know, you got into the day took on some sort of regulated pattern, and you may found that your sleeping was, as far as you were concerned, your sleeping was between 4 o'clock and 8 o'clock, depending very much on what you knew. You couldn't really ever say, but everybody had to have sleep, and you had to do your best to make sure that your platoon, your men got as much sleep as they could, and your sleeping pattern was really devised between your platoon sergeant and yourself.
On reflection, what do you think was the minimum amount of sleep that you required to remain effective as the platoon leader?
That's difficult to say, because there were days when you obviously went without sleep, but you could. It's surprising, actually, how little sleep you can manage. Really, I'm sure there were days when I had 2 or 3 hours sleep. It was just not in the routine of things. You suddenly realised you hadn't slept for 18 hours or something. But generally speaking, when you were in the line, you could evolve a routine, and you had. I was lucky. I had, I think, 2 platoon sergeants, and you've got your corporals, and you could share things out. You know, he was worked out pretty well.
Did you see a lot of the battalion commander while you were up in the line? Did
yes.
He come round.
Yes. Peter Jeffries. Colonel Peter Jeffries is amazing. He would call on you every day. He'd come round with his radio operator, wireless operator, who carried his 33 or what it was in his back, and he would stomp around with his stick, and he would call on you just about every day. And if he didn't, there was some very good reason for not doing so. He was brilliant. And of course, it was quite a lot of people to call on, but it must have kept him very fit. He was a super chap, and he came to see you every day. And if he didn't see you, you knew he'd been, because you might have been asleep, QED, and he'd see your platoon sergeant, and he would normally wake you up unless it was something really important. But he would trudge around the home just about every day.
What about higher ranking officers? Did you have many high ranking visitors?
Well, from time to time. I think that, you know, quite sensibly, they didn't want to. You know, you can feel you've got to call on people, but you don't want to, you know, you can't. Otherwise, become a nuisance. I think the brigadier called on the command, you know, battalion quarters quite frequently, which was not difficult. Okay, 3 places to call on and keep in touch, that kind of thing. But I can't remember. I'm sure it happened. The brigadier would have walked round. But there was really no need for him to do so, and, you know, it was a risk. It was an unnecessary risk, really. You know, who wants to lose a brigadier? And you don't have to be seen to be brave. You know, I mean, he would come and look. He might come up to a position to look at the Chinese from a certain point and say, hello, Barr or Smith or Jones. And you would say you've had a visit. But I don't think that he made a habit of it. And it wouldn't have been sensible anyway, you know. Just wasted life if he copped a mortar bomb or something just for being there. But one had visitors, of course, you know, the press came up from time to time. You know, the army press. Well, there was a colonel who sort of looked after the press, and they went round. It wasn't important.
How did your men respond to these visitors from the outside world, as it were?
They only cared about their immediate officer and their commanding officer. They couldn't have given them fuck about anyone else, really. You know, they knew. Because you did live in, as I say, in cells, you know. Although 3 platoon or could be over there or something. You weren't in touch, really. You were living your own bit, and they knew who their officers were and that kind of thing, and you were either liked or disliked, and that sort of thing, but you didn't. And the commanding officer would always come around and chat, and he was good, he knew everybody's name and this kind of thing. But you didn't really worry, they didn't worry about anyone else. You had too much to think about, you know. Who was the brigadier? You know, someone might know the brigadier.
Were you generally well informed about what was going on at a wider level? Was there any...
Yes and no. There were occasional, what do we call them, situation reports. And if one had the time or the inclination, you would pass it round. You know, there was a raid on the Canadians last night, or there was a raid on the Americans last Tuesday, and that sort of thing. But, you know, it didn't really affect one's life. Much more important to get your letters from home. You knew, you were in touch with your, you know, your platoon sergeant, and they would keep you in touch. But yes, we were informed, but it didn't really matter. You know, it wasn't important.
Did the mail from home come regularly?
Oh yes, very good. Mail from home was very good. It was usually a sort of, it came up every night with the rations, that kind of stuff. I remember very well because I was engaged at the time and I had a lot of letters coming up. And of course, so did the men, you know. And news from home, and gift packs and stuff, you know. The people in Durham were amazing. Although it was a hell of a long way away, we were very well looked after in that respect, you know. The war was in such an established state by then, and it was very easy. And people went on leave. You had leave in Korea and you had leave in Japan. And there was always sort of, you know, Private Smith, Private Jones, go to Busan we went or something like for 2 or 3 days rest. And then you go back to battalion quarters or gauge quarters for a bath. You know, that kind of thing. So 2 or 3 people would leave the position every day for a bath and come back in. You know, it didn't always work like that because of the weather or something going on, that kind of thing. But there was the facility was there. A day out of the line, you see, when people coming down to the line, they go back to brigaded quarters and sit on their bums and have a bit of sleep and have a shower and come back again in the evening or the next morning. You obviously couldn't afford to let too many people go, but that's the way it was.
You had a rotation,
though. Yes. Yes, down to the line, and then local leave and our